good time. It's interesting to notice how that different speakers are matched up with the varied topics, and having been around a little while and having spoken one or two lectureships, it's been interesting to me how that this occurs. I didn't realize how indicting this could be until a few years ago when I was introduced at the Pan American Lectureship, and there my subject was overcoming temptation on the mission field. And the master of ceremonies introduced me and said, Dan has wide and varied experience in the subject matter, and know he'll do a good job. I suppose that Carl McKean was looking for apathetic or pathetic, I'm not sure. I know that when he approached me, he said something like, Dan, you wouldn't want to speak on this lectureship, would you? And I said, oh, I don't think so, but you know, if you can't get anyone else, I might do that. He said, you're the man. Yeah. So having been, having exercised myself in apathy many times, well, perhaps I'm somewhat qualified, but more than anything else, we want to turn our thoughts to the world, because God so loved the world. We want to turn our thoughts to the people in the world, because this is the true world, not the geographical boundaries, the mountains and the rivers and the deserts and oceans. The people within the world, this is the object of God's love. The undeniable fact that Jesus Christ was sent to this world because of care, because of compassion. The ministry of Jesus is the most dynamic expression of compassion that the world has ever seen. The love for an individual, taking time out to care for an individual, the love for a city, the love for a nation, the love for a world, tears shed over all of those. Absolute proof of his concern, and more than his concern, his involvement, and his voluntary involvement. The Apostle Paul puts it like this. He could have stayed up there with his father, but he didn't consider that position one to be held onto or to be grasped. He emptied himself as one would pour wine out of a pitcher. He came to this earth, poured out in human form, and not just any human. He took on the form of a servant, not just any servant, but a servant unto death, and not just any death, but death on the cross. And then he was exalted. These are the examples of the one who came to seek and save the lost and to be our mentor and to call us to a noble cause. It's amazing that in that world he found people that in the name of religion could do such things as give their money to the temple and deny it to their own parents. Isn't that absolutely absurd and amazing that in the name of religion one could reach that point of legalism? I've given it all to the church. I can't give anything to you. I wish I could. Or isn't it just absolutely outlandish that the elders of the church could devour a widow's house and say, we'll pray for you, sister. But that was the exact kind of world to which our Lord came. And I'm sorry to say it hasn't changed a great deal. Now, I don't think there's anyone here that's willing to devour a widow's house. I don't think there's anyone here that wants to deny his parents or anyone else that which they need. But we fall into a trap of our own making sometimes. Our lack of understanding that is based upon our lack of involvement. Our lack of involvement because we are an isolated and blessed nation. Oftentimes, when we enter into this purpose of caring or this business of caring one for another, it is controlled by the will of the benefactor, not by the need of the recipient. I want you to remember that. That's a very important point in the lesson this morning. We won't say those words so many times, but we'll be referring to that principle many times. We have become so institutionalized and so depersonalized in our caring that it often comes across that way. It is the decision of the benefactor, the giver, and not the need of the recipient. Those of you who have lived overseas could tell many horror stories, as can I, of things that are given with all good intentions, I suppose, but they're just not needed. I worked for several years for the government of Honduras, and I noticed the gifts of our great nation to that nation. One was a multi-million dollar apparatus for cancer research. The only trouble is they had no cancer research lab. A very fine gift that had absolutely no purpose, met no need. While there were crying needs around, we had a surplus of these apparati, and so we gave one to the government. This often happens, not just in a country-to-country basis, but in a person-to-person, as we shall see. We're living in a time when the consideration or lack of consideration or the lack of understanding that we have for the people out there is coming back to haunt us. We're living in a time when the third world is rising up in protest and terrorism and all kinds of blatant things to just put across a point. They're unhappy. It seems that these headline-making exploits weigh heavily on society, even when the plight of the infirm and the starving does not. They're making a point, and I don't want to be political this morning and make a political speech, but there is a point to be made, and I hope that we can channel that point in a spiritual way to our own situation that we might better understanding the business of caring one for another. Excuse me a minute. We're going to take compassion and apathy and examine these concepts this morning and refer to three persons, the third, the second, and the first. This is not a lesson in English grammar. It is, in fact, a recognition of relationships. First of all, the third person, the third world, that about which we are oftentimes detached and disinterested, the over there syndrome. The people who do things over there, they do them differently, they do them strangely. We suffer from what I call a first world innocence, not really understanding what's going on over there, not really understanding the plight of the people there. And even this comes very close to home at times when we deal with people who migrate from the third world. I had the privilege of growing up near the Mexican border in the state of Arizona. And as a very small child, I attended a school that was primarily Hispanic. There were many confusing things about going to that school, but the most confusing of all was this. I remember very, very vividly in the second grade that there was a young friend of mine who came to school weeping. We wondered what was wrong with him, and he finally blubbered out in his tears that his little sister had died. As we continued to find out more about it, we found out that his baby sister had died of dehydration, of diarrhea. And there was just an awful pall of helplessness that overcame me as a second grader. I just couldn't comprehend, how did this little baby die? Here we had all these fine doctors and hospitals around us. What happened? Why did she die? I realize now as I look back that there weren't any doctors there who would have allowed her to come in and bring her baby if she had had the money to do so. But I went to the teacher and I said, "Teacher, why didn't someone help this little baby?" And her answer was so absolutely ludicrous. "I didn't believe it then. I know it's not right now. It's emblazoned itself in my soul for the years that I have lived." She said, "Danny, you just got to understand that those people are used to losing their babies. Have you ever heard anything like that in your life?" That insipid reply was the only defense that the Anglo community had. They are accustomed to losing their babies. "Oh yes," they just say, "oh my goodness, we lost another one. It doesn't matter, 9 months we'll have one more." Why, of course not. The most ridiculous and cruel reply I've ever heard in my life. I don't think she's a cruel lady. I don't think she's a ridiculous lady. She just absolutely did not know and made no effort to know. The xenophobic suspicion of those people over there, or those people that are right here among us, but they are of that stripe, leads us to conclusions like the one that a friend of mine gave me when I reason he gave me for not accompanying me to Latin America one time. He'd been greatly blessed. He and I grew up together. He should know better. He's inherited a very vast fortune. I went to see him as a friend, and I said, "The Lord has blessed you so much. I know that you want to use it for His glory. Why don't you accompany me down into South America? There are so many fine things there that you can do with your blessings to help the cause of Christ and help humanity." And after many, many evasive types of answers, he said this: "I ain't lost nothing down there." Of course he hadn't lost anything down there. That's not the point, my friend. He'll never find anything down there. And that's a human tragedy. He'll never find that pearl of great price. He'll never find that which is worth our giving up everything to find. He'll never find the value of human commitment and human relationship and the great things that the entire world bring into the kingdom. This is what the book tells us. The kings of the earth bring their glories into the kingdom of God. And each one of us enjoys the products, the philosophies, the ideas and ideals of those who come into the kingdom. That's why the church is universal. That's why the church is the way that it is, that we might bless one another with the things that we bring into the kingdom. We forget a very, very important teaching of the Apostle Paul. In 1 Corinthians 13, when he's talking about love, he said, "I can give everything that I own to the poor. And if I don't do it out of the right motivation, it profits me nothing." Now listen to him. Giving to the poor will profit them something. If I gave everything that I own to the poor, they would profit some. But if I do it for any other reason than that which is the motivating power of agape that brings us all together in one family as brothers and sisters, if I do it for any other reason than that which the Lord has demonstrated in His life, it doesn't profit me anything. If I do it for a show, if I do it for a story, if I do it for praise, I miss out on the blessing, the profit that the Lord wants me to have. Generosity without compassion is a terrible, terrible state of mind. I don't agree with people that say that we're not a generous people. We are. The American people are a very generous people, especially the members of the church. I'm amazed at how many of you will write a check when I ask you to do so for people in Latin America and other places of the world. I think we're a very generous people. But we have that feeling of, let me do this, but leave me alone. Let me be detached. Let me be over here and let them stay over there. I went to visit a former student of mine in one of the countries, South America, and he picked me up in his shiny new car. I complimented his car, and he was very proud of it. It's fine for a man to have a shiny new car. We drove back to the place where I would be staying, and as we pulled in, a whole herd of little boys came running out there, hollering, "Señor, cuida el carro, cuida el carro. Can I take care of your car for you?" And he steered that car directly for them. My heart just jumped up in my throat and I screamed, "What are you doing?" He barely missed them. I don't know how he missed one of the little fellows that fell down. And pulled in there, and I looked at him in utter astonishment. I said, "What on earth did you do that for?" "Well, I get tired of those kids always hanging around. They're always touching my car and leaving fingerprints on it." I was fit to be tied. I said, "Look here, friend, if you think more of that shiny car than you do these people, then take your car and go home and do it now. We don't need you down here if that's your attitude." not a bad person. But what can make a person think that way? I believe it goes back primarily to an unwillingness to become involved. Just an unwillingness to see who they are, to find out how they think, to live with them, to eat with them, to sleep with them, and to appreciate them. As one young man told me in Guatemala when I was a new missionary there, he said, "You Americans extend hospitality very well, but you extend it on your terms." We come back telling wonderful tales, and we write wonderful tales about our experiences in Latin America and Asia and Africa and all over the world. I call these stories better told than felt, because there's too many of us who can tell them eloquently and feel them very, very little. It's so easy to pass by the nameless face there that has her hand out for you. Thank God for children. Seems like the Lord said something about them in the kingdom, didn't he? Thank God that every once in a while a little girl will look at her daddy, whom she knows to be a compassionate person. Said, "Daddy, you gonna walk by that lady? She has two little babies. Aren't you gonna help her? Give me my allowance so I can give it to her." But honey, there's so many of them. And we don't even know who she is. There's so many on the streets, and you become accustomed to them. Then it came home to me. That lady in my second grade teacher had it all wrong. They don't become accustomed to poverty and to death. It is we who become accustomed to their plight. That's the problem. We become so accustomed to seeing it, so accustomed to smelling it, so accustomed to being around it. And besides that, logic is on our side. You know, they might want it for the wrong purposes. They might become rice Christians. We can deductively and inductively send our souls to hell with logic. And we ignore what the Lord has plainly said and shown us. Let's go a step further. From the nameless person to the person whom we know, the second person. They're the people I meet, the people I know. In the fifth chapter of the book of Matthew, verses 21 and following, the Lord said this: "You've heard it said not to kill. And certainly anyone who kills his neighbor, anyone must come to judgment." He said, "I say to you, if you're angry with your brother, you better watch out. You'll be liable to judgment." Well, that's reasonable. I can buy that. I can't go around being angry with my brother all the time. Then he says, "If you insult your brother, you'll have to go before the council." Well, I can't go around spreading all kinds of lies and libels about my brother. I can understand that. But then he says, "If you say to your brother, 'You fool,' you'll be liable to the hell of fire." Now, wait a minute. That sounds pretty serious, doesn't it? That sounds pretty deep. If I call someone a fool, well, I need to understand what he's talking about there. This particular terminology is very difficult to translate. It means this: if I look upon you, if I meet you and I see you, and I have utter contempt for you, you who have been created in the image of God, you who bear God's image in your being, you for whom Christ died, and I say, "I care not a whit for you. Get out of my way. Your problem doesn't bother me. I want nothing to do with you." Then I have said, "You're just a fool. You're not a person." I have depersonalized him, and the Lord said, "Watch out. You're on your way to hell." Now, Jesus tells me that he takes it very personally how I treat the ones whom we esteem the least. Isn't that what he says in Matthew 25? He's not saying I consider one of less importance than you, but the one whom you consider of least importance. I'm going to take it very personally, how you treat that person. Now, you know, I love God, don't you? Anyone here doesn't like God? Of course not. It's easy to love God. Who wouldn't love God? Look at all of the things that he's done for us. Of course we love him. You know why we love him? He never calls us at 2 o'clock in the morning and says, I'm broken down out here on Interstate 20, come get me. He never knocks on the door and says, here we are, we're going to stay a while with you. Or can you lend me 200? I'm kind of short and my baby's sick. Never see that. Never hear that. Oh, do we love the church. Oh, yes. See, in the abstract, we can love God, we can love the church. When it gets down to the individuals, it's like my father, who served for many years as an elder in the church in Arizona. He came home one night for an especially tiring session with some problematic people there in the church. And I was home after my freshman year as a student here at ACU, and I was chiding him somewhat, and I said, oh, Dad, you just don't love the brethren. And he said, son, I love the brethren. He said, I love the church. It's just the members I can't stand. And that's the way it becomes sometimes, doesn't it? Love the brethren, love the church, and love the Lord, but keep those members away from me. You know, I think the best example I've ever seen of instant involvement with a second person was done by a good friend of mine. I'm sorry to say that to this day, as far as I know, he's never become a Christian. He's had a lot of teaching, and I pray that he will one day. Dr. L.A. Berry, with whom I worked in Honduras, he and I went out on a little trip one time to a village, and we had the one hotel on the square, no running water. We wanted to go fishing in the lake nearby. And as we stood outside the hotel, well, here came a little old ragamuffin kid. Oh, he was a mess. His shirt was hanging on just by knotting the ends of the rags. He was dirty. His hair was just all matted and messy, and his face was just all snotty. Can I use that word? And he was a terrible sight, and he came up and put out a pitiful little hand and said, un cinquito, por favor. Give me 5 cents, please. Dr. Berry looked at him and said, what? He said, no. He said, quit squealing at me like a banshee. He said, talk to me like a person. Un cinquito. He said, no. Settle down, clear your throat, and tell me what you want, boy. Finally, he said, un cinquito, por favor. He said, well, now you're talking like a human being. He said, you scared me to death. I thought you were some kind of wild animal screaming at me. And the kid kind of smiled. He said, now I understand you need some money. That's right. Well, what do you need it for? Well, I need it for food and for clothes. He said, well, let's go get some clothes. He went down to the store and bought him a shirt and a pair of trousers, brought him back to our hotel room and took the basin of water. Before he put the new clothes on him, stripped him down, washed him off with his washcloth, washed his hair, took his comb out of his hip pocket and combed his hair, washed all that snotty goo off of his face, put on a new shirt and a new pair of pants, and said, go over there and see if you recognize yourself. The little kid stood there and just smiled. He said, now let's go get something to eat. We went and got something to eat. He said, now what you need is a job. He said, boy, will I get a job? He said, if you're a clean, respectable boy, you'll find a job. So you quit going around squealing and acting like an idiot. He said, go over here and go in these stores and say, I'm a poor but honest boy and I need a job. The third store he went to, he got a job. He was smiling from ear to ear when we left there. I have an idea that he's one of the leading citizens in that community today. Just because this man took the time to say, hey, you dirty little ragamuffin, there is a beautiful human being in there somewhere, and we're going to bring it out. That's what it's all about. That's what it's all about. Oh, but let's bring it down to the first person. You know, am I a compassionate person? Well, I give. No, that isn't the question. Am I a compassionate person? You know, our culture militates against it. I got to look out for number one. I'm a self-made man. He's got the same chance that I have. And no one makes a fool out of Dan Coker. Except Dan does every once in a while, but that's beside the point. No one makes a fool out of me. Why, I tried to help a person, and guess what? Let me tell you two quick true incidents. Man came to my house, and I said, well, you look like a healthy fellow. I said, I'll give you a job. You can cut some weeds and stuff out behind my house. I got a brand new machete here for you to use. I said, Lise, why don't we make him a plate? And she took it out there, and he sat down, ate a big meal, and I said, you do a good job cutting the grass and the weeds, and I'll pay you. And he did, and I paid him, and he stole my machete. Well, I ain't gonna help another. That's what we want to say, isn't it? Lady came by, just crying and wailing. Oh, kind sir, would you give me a clean white sheet? Well, what for? Well, my baby died, and I need a sheet to bury the poor little thing. He said, you know, aren't you going to get a coffin? Oh, no, you know, we're too poor. Just a clean white sheet to wrap the body. He said, we're poor, that's all we need, just a sheet. Well, what old meanie wouldn't give a sheet to a poor lady to wrap her dead baby in? Of course, what she was doing, she was taking sheets down at the market and going in the sheet business. That's how she got them. Well, that old heifer, I'll never help her again. You know, this attitude is amazing, just how much it permeates our thinking. I sit down often with elders and say, would you consider supporting this man or this family or this work? Well, now, Dan, we got burned. Here a while back, I heard that one time too often. We tried doing mission work, and we got burned. And I said, well, good. Oh, you don't understand, Brother Coker, we got burned. I said, isn't that wonderful? At least you got close enough to the fire to get burned. Most people don't even get that close. I said, have you ever been burned in your pulpit, man? What do you mean? Have you ever been disappointed in a pulpit, man? Has anyone ever done you bad? One deacon said, well, you know, we had one run off with the secretary. Oh, I said, well, surely you never hired another one. You got burned that bad. You wouldn't hire another pulpit man if one did you that badly. That's the logic we use for missions. That's why we have so few in the mission field today. We got burned. Can't you hear the Lord? Well, I've already been burned several times. They tried to kill me when I was a baby, tried to throw me over a cliff in my hometown. I'm tired of this, Lord. Just take me home. He was burned pretty badly on the cross, wouldn't you say? You know, I had two preachers tell me here a while back that the Great Commission is no longer applicable, that it was only for the first century Christians. I said, well, then I guess the command to multiply and replenish the earth was only for Adam and Eve. The logic sometimes, you know, just fails me. I can't quite grasp, but I do know why. You know, it's about as illogical as anything we do, bringing children into the world. You talk about taking a risk. They might be drug addicts, they might be prostitutes, they might be crooks, they might disgrace our name, disgrace the church, they might lose their soul in hell. The safe thing to do is not bring any children into this world. Besides that, they're a bunch of ingrates. They smell terrible and they scream all the time. Why in the world would anyone want a child? Because it's the nature of man and woman to want a child and show instant and complete compassion for that child. It's the nature of God to bring sons into glory. It's the nature of His true church to bring sons into glory. It's the nature of the church of Christ to heed His command. It's the nature of the church of Christ to go into all the world. It's the nature of the Church of Christ to bring sons into glory and to make sure that everyone has a chance of hearing this gospel. It is the very underlying, underpinning command of our movement, our reason for being. And if we're not doing that, God help us, we ought not to exist. The only first I've seen lately in missions among the churches of Christ is that that's the first thing to go in hard economic times. We achieve that first. Shame on us. Shame on us. There's a world out there that needs to eat, needs to sleep safely, needs to be educated, and all of those pursuits are so noble. But most of all, there's a world out there that so desperately needs a living hope. And if we don't have that to offer, let's take down our shingle and have a good time now.